Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and in the next two half-hour segments, we're going to be discussing some of the sub rosa politics of the petroleum industry, or the oil business, as they call it down in Texas. That is, of course, referential because as I speak on March 19th of the year 2000, we're not only in a presidential election year, but the Republican nominee is an oil man, George W. Bush, the son of George H.W. Bush, former CIA director, Nazi collaborator, and himself the offspring of a family deeply involved with the financing of the Third Reich. And the two Georges Bush may very well be involved with the Bormann Group that I've spoken about so many times. For the record, program 113 and number 186 go into some of these details, as well as other programs available from Spitfire, a tape duplication service about which we'll have more to say later. In an interview with John Loftus, the co-author of a book we're about to excerpt at considerable length, we discussed, this by the way done in June of 1995, we discussed, among other things, the fact that the oil shortage, quote-unquote, of 1979 was deliberately manufactured. It was a phony oil shortage created by the petroleum industry not only to destroy Jimmy Carter politically and get the Republicans in office, but also to achieve a number of other objectives as well, not the least of which was to make the public receptive to an enormous increase in the price of gasoline and a consequent increase in profits for the petroleum industry. There was a German historian whose name escapes me off the top of my head who noted quite appropriately that history teaches us that we learn nothing from history, particularly when we don't bother reading about that history. Well, if people haven't read about it, at least they can tape the next 2 half hours and learn a little bit about what has gone on and what is going on, and perhaps we will learn from some of the history and some of the history that we're living through. The following article is from the San Francisco Chronicle of Saturday, March 11th of the year 2000. This is one of a number of articles about the enormous increase in the price of gasoline, something that is not only making consumers uncomfortable, but something that may very well lead to across-the-board price increases, because just about everything is dependent directly or indirectly upon the price of petroleum and gasoline. Again, the Chronicle of Saturday, 3/11/2000, an article by David Lazarus, and this is headlined, Oil Prices Presage Expensive Summer. It reads in part as follows. Think things cost a lot now? Just wait until summer arrives. The International Energy Agency all but promised that consumer prices would head north when it reported yesterday that oil inventories in the world's richest countries have dropped to their lowest levels in 4 years. It's even worse in the United States, where oil inventories have plunged to 10-year lows, according to San Francisco's Chevron Corporation. Severin Borenstein, B-O-R-E-N-S-T-E-I-N, director of the University of California Energy Institute at Berkeley, sees the reductions as a sign that, quote, we could have a pretty tight gasoline market, unquote. It's going to be an expensive summer, he said, continuing with the article. Wallet-numbing prices probably will be felt across the board. Along with shelling out more money at the pump, consumers can almost certainly expect to pay more for airline tickets, as well as for anything with a related delivery cost, which is just about everything. Quote, when we had a rapid rise in oil prices in the 70s, that was a contributing factor to inflation, unquote, said Paul Moreno, a spokesman for the California State Automobile Association. Quote, it affects consumers at every level, unquote. The U.S. Energy Department warned earlier this week that, quote, retail gasoline prices are poised to surge to unprecedented levels before the spring is out, unquote. The State Auto Association said that the average price of a gallon of regular unleaded gas at self-service pumps throughout California hit $1.63 this week, up 11.5 cents in a week. The latest numbers will be released Tuesday, quote, we're well into record territory, unquote. Moreno said. Well, as indicated, the oil shortage and the enormous gas lines and the increase in the price of gasoline in 1979 was deliberately manufactured in order to do a number of things, including and especially get rid of Jimmy Carter, who came out solidly in favor of petroleum conservation. There were a number of other political and strategic objectives behind the petroleum industry's deliberate manufacturing of the quote, oil shortage, unquote, that in collusion with major oil producers, especially Saudi Arabia and the associated Aramco, the Arabian American Oil Company. This was also done in collusion with the Central Intelligence Agency. Bear in mind that the Republican vice presidential candidate in 1980 was none other than George Herbert Walker Bush, who later, of course, became president and who prior to that, of course, was director of Central Intelligence and himself a career oil man. His son, again, George W. Bush, is, of course, now the Republican nominee for president. And although we are being told that there is absolutely nothing to be done about this petroleum shortage and the rise in gas, one, I think, should take that with a generous grain of salt. Whether or not oil producers are deliberately holding down production in order to increase the price, or whether this is simply a deliberate bottleneck at the refining level, I think that it's important to understand the political history of, quote, oil shortages, unquote, particularly as it relates to the Bush family and their attempts to move into the White House directly or indirectly. One should also not lose sight of the fact that George H.W. Bush was director of the CIA, and there's a very intimate relationship historically between the CIA and the petroleum industry. I would also note that there's a very intimate history, very intimate relationship historically between the Third Reich and its successor, the Underground Reich, as I've called it, and the petroleum industry. We're going to turn for a review of the oil shortage, quote-unquote, of 1979 and the resulting destabilization of Jimmy Carter, the increase in prices across the board, and some of the other unsavory effects of that particular gambit. And we're going to turn to a book, for information about that, we're going to turn to a book called The Secret War Against the Jews, subtitled How Western Espionage Betrayed the Jewish People. This book was co-authored by John Loftus and Mark Ahrens, A-A-R-O-N-S, published in hardcover and softcover by the St. Martin's Press, copyright 1994. This book, by the way, as I speak, is still available in softcover. John Loftus was a career military officer and former Justice Department investigator with a very high security clearance, and among the many sources he was able to draw on for this book were a group of intelligence agents from the United States and Britain, retired intelligence agents, whom he termed the old spies, and who were able to produce their information under condition of anonymity. John Loftus had power of attorney for these, quote, old spies, unquote. In addition, this 510-page book, at least in the hardcover edition, has 135 pages of footnotes. And we're going to turn to John Loftus and Mark Ahrens' account of the deliberate sabotage of the Carter administration by the petroleum industry and elements of the Central Intelligence Agency on behalf of, among others, George Herbert Walker Bush. And I think, again, we need to bear this in mind as we experience Campaign 2000 and George W., and an individual with the same relationship to the petroleum industry that his father had. We turn to the secret war against the Jews and writing of Jimmy Carter. Loftus and Ahrens say, quote, actually I shouldn't quote this, this is coming from the book. It is hard to recall why he was so despised when he was in office. Much of it has to do with the secret history of oil politics. Even during the 1976 election campaign, the oil companies viewed the Democratic candidate as public enemy number one. Carter certainly had some radical ideas about energy policy, which made the oil companies fearful for the future and their profit levels. Carter's first move after the election didn't please them. He nominated former CIA head and Defense Secretary James Schlesinger as his Secretary of Energy. Beginning again, Carter's first move after the election didn't please them. He nominated former CIA head and Defense Secretary James Schlesinger as his Secretary of Energy. Schlesinger had been the first CIA director to confront James Angleton in 25 years. By the way, James Jesus Angleton was the CIA's former head of counterintelligence and the head of an agency within the agency that was virtually autonomous unto itself. This was an individual who ran afoul of many of the newer players in the intelligence agency because of his fascistic and in many ways counterproductive policies. Nonetheless, he was extremely powerful. That's the reference here to James Angleton. Continuing, speaking of Schlesinger and his antipathy to Angleton, Loftus and Ahrens write, He had been around during the stable cleaning at the CIA earlier in the 1970s and knew where many of the bodies were buried. Worse still, Schlesinger was now a convert to environmentalism, unquote. Conservation and efficiency were the new buzzwords. In their first few months in office in 1977, Schlesinger and Carter made energy their number one policy issue. The oil companies had noted that during his campaign, the incoming president, quote, had promised a national energy policy within 90 days of Inauguration Day, unquote. By the way, interjecting, I would note that although Al Gore, certainly the Democratic nominee, certainly has numerous corporate connections, Al Gore also has a on-track record of pro-environmental issues, and he's come out very strongly against global warming, and the consumption of fossil fuels has much to do with that. Do note that as one listens to the following, beginning again with the last couple of sentences. Worse still, Schlesinger, the energy secretary, was now a convert to environmentalism. Conservation and efficiency were the new buzzwords. In their first few months in office in 1977, Schlesinger and Carter made energy their number one policy issue. The oil companies had noted that during his campaign, the incoming president, quote, had promised a national energy policy within 90 days of Inauguration Day, unquote. The oil men also noticed that Carter, quote, was dedicated to making good on his word, unquote. For most of 1977, new energy and oil policies were practically all that was on the agenda. The energy crisis virtually became a moral crusade. Even before Americans voted for Carter, the oil industry had launched a quiet crusade of its own in anticipation of a Democratic victory. In the last months of the Ford administration, the CIA had developed a series of papers on energy and oil issues. Just after his victory in November of 1976, Carter was shown a classified CIA analysis of global oil supplies. The old spies, unquote, we asked about this point, insist that the report had a powerful impact on Carter and helped to define his policies on the, quote, energy crisis, unquote. When Carter launched his National Energy Plan in April of 1977, he confirmed that the CIA had provided him with intelligence assessments which made dire predictions about future energy supplies in the Soviet Union. The CIA warning made front page news, quote, Russia would be importing oil from the Middle East by 1985, unquote. The Soviets would need to buy 3.5 million barrels per day, to be precise, whereas in 1977, they actually exported 1.5 million barrels daily. Quote, previously, the assumption had been that the Soviets would continue to be self-sufficient in meeting their oil and gas needs, unquote. In order to bolster his energy crusade, unquote, the president was using the CIA to whip up a public frenzy about a looming conflict in the Middle East between the Soviet Union and the United States. The Associated Press ominously reported that, quote, in a few years, the USSR will face an energy crisis that is likely to sharpen U.S.-Soviet rivalries in the Middle East, CIA analysts predict. In effect, the CIA was telling President Carter that the Soviet Union would face a domestic oil shortage in 1985, causing the worst energy crisis in American history. When the Soviets ran out of domestic oil supplies, they probably would look to the traditional oil suppliers of the United States, especially Saudi Arabia and Kuwait. Our sources in the intelligence community say that the CIA's oil shortfall, unquote, probably was the greatest intelligence fraud in American history. James Jesus Angleton would have been envious. His vessel fraud had hidden one tiny corner of Allen Dulles' covert operations, but in the long run, the forgeries he passed to Presidents Roosevelt and Truman only had limited foreign policy effects. This refers to Angleton's forgery of some communications allegedly intercepted from the Vatican. Continuing, that's the reference to the vessel fraud. Continuing here. The oil fraud of the 1970s succeeded in getting the U.S. president to change his policy toward Israel and the Arabs completely, and directly promoted the massive defense expenditures of the 1980s, all based on the false premise that the Soviets needed oil and were planning to invade the Middle East. Some of the former intelligence officers we spoke to were adamant that the CIA was not to blame. They claim that CIA contacts in the oil industry cooked the books on the Soviet shortage by feeding misleading data to the CIA. Quote, "The agency had grown fat and lazy in the Middle East," explained one of our sources. Again quoting, "The oil companies were a big retirement area for ex-CIA staff. There were so many ex-CIA working for the oil companies that it was easy to fake the data," unquote. Of course, ex-CIA is a term that should be taken with a generous dose of salt. Note also here that Jimmy Carter made a bargain with the devil, although he believed the CIA assessment and was sincerely deceived. Ultimately, his conservation policies were sabotaged, and Jimmy Carter himself was destabilized by, among other things, the inflation that helped to push him out of office and Ronald Reagan and George Bush in. Note that as we continue. Others in the intelligence community say that it was not the underlying data that were bad as much as the analysis that was skewed back at headquarters. Quote, "You have to understand who was screwing the Jews," unquote, one old spy told us. By the way, this refers to the petroleum industry's long-standing anti-Israel policy underlying the official pro-U.S. policy of the United States. Continuing. Underlying and in contrast with, I should say. Continuing. Quote, "The whole phony scheme, the oil shortages, the predictions about Soviet troops in the Middle East, the Saudi arms buildup, all of that crap started coming out of the agency back in 76. The CIA told their boss what he wanted to hear, and in those days, the head of the CIA was an oil man." That, of course, was George Bush. Continuing, "Perhaps the truth was somewhere in between. The CIA field agents slanted the data a bit to suit the oil industry, and the analysis exaggerated a bit more, and the analysts exaggerated a bit more. According to several of our sources, the scheme to manufacture phony CIA estimates and push them on Carter began in the last days of Gerald Ford's term. They claim that a cabal within the CIA realized that Carter would be the new president, produced the first phony report, and then promptly gave it to Carter as soon as he won, knowing how it would affect his view of the energy crisis. It should be recalled that George Bush was the director of the CIA at the time the oil scam was put in place in 1976. There is some evidence to suggest that it was Bush himself who passed the fake oil estimates to Carter." One more time. "It should be recalled that George Bush was the director of the CIA at the time the oil scam was put in place in 1976. There is some evidence to suggest that it was Bush himself who passed the fake oil estimates to Carter. In the immediate aftermath of Carter's win, Bush traveled to Plains, Georgia to brief the incoming president. According to Bush's own autobiography, halfway through a five-hour session with Carter, quote, one of my deputies, Dan Murphy, began outlining long-range national security problems facing the country. He mentioned a particular problem due to come to a head around 1985, unquote. Now, it may just be a coincidence, but the CIA report prepared in late 1976, unquote, that influenced Carter's energy policy also predicted that 1985 would be the crunch year for Soviet oil production. Perhaps Bush was referring to some other matter, quote, due to come to a head around 1985, unquote. But it seems like a very improbable coincidence. According to several of our sources, George Bush made a stupid mistake by mentioning his November 1976 briefing of Jimmy Carter. These sources believe that George Bush himself had wanted to emphasize the most pessimistic estimates of future oil production. Although it is impossible to verify their claims, it seems highly probable that Bush was, at the very least, present at the moment when the first CIA oil estimate was passed to Carter. It is possible that his last major official act as CIA head was to approve the overly pessimistic estimates, but on the other hand, it all just may be coincidental. I would interject, if you believe that, contact me through Spitfire because I've got some land for you in Florida. Continuing, right in the middle of the Everglades, I would add, and I'll sell it to you cheap. Continuing, as will be seen in the concluding chapters, such coincidences kept recurring throughout George Bush's career. Whatever the truth of Bush's own knowledge of the false predictions planted on Carter, there can be no dispute that someone in the CIA gave the new president the bogus information while Bush was still CIA director. Whoever it was kept up the forgeries on a regular basis right through Carter's term, well after Bush had departed. There were, of course, many who suspected right away that the CIA's prediction of a Soviet oil crisis by 1985 was just a con. The Washington Post was particularly critical, noting that even some of Carter's own cabinet members did not accept the red threat thesis, unquote. And quoting directly from the Washington Post here, that oil shortfall projection is widely disputed because one of its key premises is the Central Intelligence Agency's prophecy that the Soviet Union and its satellites, which now sell energy to other nations, will be importing 3.5 million barrels a day by 1985. This prediction, unveiled by the White House when President Carter announced his energy plan, is now regarded with considerable skepticism. And then Loftus and Ahrens continue, in fact, the CIA's revisionist analysis, unquote, came under immediate, serious challenge by West European intelligence agencies, by the Library of Congress, by the Soviets, and, somewhat surprisingly, by James Schlesinger. Although Energy Secretary Schlesinger was the loudest voice in support of Carter's plan for dramatic policy changes to deal with the gas, quote, shortfall, unquote, he was less than impressed by the CIA predictions. Perhaps, as a former CIA director, Schlesinger smelled the unpleasant odor of a set of cooked figures, unquote. Although he was careful in his public comments to defend the agency from any hint of such a charge, Schlesinger simply couldn't believe the Soviets would let themselves be boxed into a position where they'd have to buy oil from anybody, unquote. He was supported by most reputable oil experts, one of whom claimed that far from facing oil imports, the Russians are floating on a sea of oil, unquote. On the other hand, Carter's new CIA head, Admiral Stansfield Turner, defended the analyst's predictions eloquently and forcefully. He had no idea someone at the CIA was forging the figures in favor of the oil companies. The common view at the time was that the CIA figures had been produced to support President Carter's energy program. Our sources say the opposite. The sudden shortage of gasoline was a propaganda ploy by the oil industry, an opportunistic bid to frighten the American people into allowing it to increase their profits by removing domestic price caps. And skipping down, the oil companies and the Saudi government both had access to similar advice from old CIA hands. It almost seemed that Aramco, the Arabian American oil company, had more of its ex-employees inside the CIA than the CIA had agents in the Middle East. In public, the Saudis dismissed the report as ridiculous and obviously untrue, unquote. In private, they went along with the CIA's declining production, unquote, fraud. After some reflection, the House of Saud realized that here was an opportunity to sell less oil but make more money. In public, the Saudis continued to insist they had plenty of oil. In practice, they helped create an oil shortage. The CIA had created a self-fulfilling prophecy. The Saudis' reserves mysteriously fell by millions of barrels a day, and their pumping efficiency was said to be atrocious and sure to get worse. In a very short time, American consumers would find themselves running out of gas. In light of the almost unanimous criticism of the CIA's forecasts, there was much speculation, quote, about the agency's motives and integrity, unquote, and there was open talk of its political motivation, unquote. Frank Church, the head of the Senate committee that had investigated the CIA, claimed that the agency tended to accept a level of oil production that they'd hoped for without weighing other information, unquote. The implication was that the agency was supporting the president's new energy policies. Our sources in the intelligence community state bluntly that someone in the CIA was manipulating the truth for political ends, but not to bolster the president. The idea was to undermine Carter and destroy his support for Israel. In fact, our sources say that the whole oil scare campaign was designed to justify supporting a pro-Arab peace initiative and then to make the Saudis the new superpower in the Middle East. In the long run, The revisionist CIA predictions on oil were nothing more than a ploy permanently to reverse U.S. policy toward Israel. By the way, this is one of the few areas here where I disagree with the analysis by Loftus and Ahrens. I believe that this was one of the objectives, but I believe it was only one of them. And indeed, I think Loftus and Ahrens' own commentary here embraces a much wider analysis. Obviously, the petroleum companies were trying to destabilize Jimmy Carter, and the profit motive here was paramount to all others. Also, other strategic and military initiatives and strategic considerations as well. Oh, by the way, I would note that in the July 26, 1992 installment of RFA 37, How the United States Lost the Second World War, I discussed George Bush Sr.'s, George Herbert Walker Bush's, history as a petroleum industry professional and the almost certain probability that it was inextricably linked with his involvement with the CIA, which in all likelihood his CIA career extended almost from his days as a Yale graduate. In all likelihood, the entire scope of his involvement with the petroleum industry was coterminous with his involvement with the CIA and inextricably linked with same. I would also note that in For the Record Program 186, we dealt with George W. Bush's relationship with James R. Bath. James R. Bath alleges that he was a CIA operative recruited by George Bush Sr. when he was director of the CIA. And James R. Bath was an individual who invested in Arbusto Energy, George W.'s first oil company. James R. Bath had almost no money of his own at the time, and in all likelihood, that money that he invested in George W.'s Arbusto Energy, which Arbusto, by the way, is Spanish for Bush, that money in all likelihood came from James R. Bath's Saudi clients. James R. Bath was deeply involved with Saudi Arabian clients, and he was the Texas representative for the bin Laden family. That is the family of Osama bin Laden, the number one terrorist on the U.S.'s terrorism list. So bear all of that in mind. We're going to continue with this analysis on the other side of this tape in the next half-hour segment of For the Record Program number 214. The various tapes that I've alluded to are available from a tape duplication service called Spitfire. They can be reached by regular mail at P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, capital B-E-N, capital L-O-M-O-N-D, zip code 95005. That's Spitfire, P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, 95005. The email address is spitfire@ix.netcom.com. That's spitfire@ix.netcom.com. You can also reach see a list of and description of the various programs available from Spitfire on the Spitfire website at spitfirelist.com. That website is equipped with real audio. We're going to continue with this analysis of the phony oil shortage of 1979. I would also note in that regard that George Bush Sr., was head of the Republican National Committee during the first oil shortage of 1973 and the resulting gas shortage. May want to remember that as well. We're going to continue with this analysis in Side 2, the second half of For the Record Program 214. That concludes this half-hour segment. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.